now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to Governing to Win, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. In the March 2012 Harvard Business Review article, The Looming Challenge to U.S. Competitiveness, the authors point out that the U.S. faces a deeper, more fundamental challenge than recovering from a recession of unusual depth and duration, and that is its ability to compete globally. Quote, to restore its competitiveness, America needs a long-term strategy. With the release of the IBM Center book, Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, the editor Chuck Proh brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. Since its release, we've dedicated a series of shows that have introduced you to many of the book's contributors, highlighted their insights and perspectives as detailed in Governing to Win. In today's conversation, we'll explore two of the three core sections of the book with a host of contributors. Why is fiscal sustainability integral to national competitiveness? What are the federal government's long-term cost drivers? How can we craft a nonpartisan framework for setting national priorities? How can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance national competitiveness? What does the role of governance, strategic budgeting, and procurement play in enhancing national competitiveness? We'll explore these questions and so much more with Chuck Proh, Dave Walker, Larry Haas, Steve Redburn, Gail Fossler, and Raj Sharma, all contributors to Governing to Win, a new book from the IBM Center for the Business of Government. The U.S. cannot address its economic prospects without a clear understanding of what we mean by competitiveness and how it shapes U.S. prosperity. The concept is widely misunderstood, with dangerous consequences for political discourse, policy, and corporate choices that are all too evident today. So what is national competitiveness? Governing to Win contributors Dave Walker, the former Comptroller General of the United States and CEO of the Comeback America Initiative, and Larry Haas, author of Sound the Trumpets, explain. First up, Dave Walker.
Competitiveness means the ability to compete effectively on a global basis. For example, from an economic standpoint in connection with world markets, you know, it's affected by many things, including our fiscal and monetary policy, our education system, how much we do in the area of research and development, the status of our critical infrastructure, healthcare costs, our tax system. So it's a very important and multidimensional issue.
As Walker notes, this is a very important multidimensional issue that has implications on the fiscal security of the United States. Larry Haas elaborates.
Well, of course, the root is competition or compete, and it really has to do with a country's place in the world. And to the extent that you want to improve U.S. competitiveness in this case, you need to create the right economic environment. You need to have the right monetary policy, regulatory policy, fiscal policy. So you want the Fed to be handling monetary policy correctly, and you want policymakers not to be overregulating, not to be overtaxing, and on the spending side, to be investing in the kinds of things that grow an economy. That has to do with hard things like infrastructure, roads, bridges, internet, so that businesses can be competitive. And on the human capital side, it has a lot to do with education. You want to make sure that you've got a workforce that's well-educated and skilled so that they are ready for the increasingly sophisticated jobs of the future. So in essence, what you're doing to the extent that you have a competitive nation, you have followed and created the policies that put your businesses and your people in a position to win in an increasingly competitive global environment. That's what competitiveness is.
So given its critical importance, Chuck Pro, editor of Governing to Win, explains why he put this book together. It's about framing the conversation.
What prompted us to put the book together was just our attempt at framing the conversation. Okay, this isn't about, you know, looking at, you know, small pieces of government and concluding that it either works well or doesn't work well. You know, what the book is intended to do is to provide that context that says, as an enterprise, the way we run and manage the federal government has a substantial or a substantive role in improving our national competitiveness. Imagine if, as the largest consumer of undergraduate talent, we were also the most effective institution at developing that talent. You know, imagine if, as the largest consumer of healthcare, we were actually setting the standards for the way we drive down cost of healthcare over time and improve the way healthcare is administered in the United States. Imagine if, as the largest consumer of energy, we were the gold standard in energy efficiency and the consumption of energy.
Recognizing that the way we run and manage the federal government has a significant role in improving our national competitiveness, here's Chuck Pro outlining the core themes of his book, Governing to Win.
The first chapter describes the fiscal situation we're in. It also tries to make the point that this is not about being Republican or Democrat, right or left. It's about being Americans. And as Americans, our government has some significant structural financial issues. The second section is focused on healthcare, energy, and education. The third chapter is focused on the aspects of managing the federal government. It is really managing government. It is the application of technology. It is the way we run our supply chains. It provides some real-world example of where government is operating very, very effectively today. And hopefully what this book tries to do is to put that in context. So we're framing the economic situation in the federal government. We're talking about three very large issues of energy, health, and education. And then finally, we're talking about how we actually manage government.
As Pro acknowledges, the way we run and manage the federal government contributes to enhancing our national competitiveness. Contributor Dave Walker diagnoses the situation with perfect clarity, crafting a sober reality.
Well, candidly, I believe the federal government has grown too big, promised too much, and waited too long to restructure, but it's not too late. And one of the reasons that we are where we are today is because we've strayed from some of the key principles and values that were the basis of the founding of our nation and that helped to make us great. Things like limited but effective government, individual liberty and opportunity, personal responsibility and accountability, rule of law and equal justice under the law, fiscal responsibility and intergenerational equity, and a key concept of stewardship. In my view, we're violating all of these key principles and values today to differing degrees, and we need to come back to them in order to help create a better future.
At first blush, the problem of the growing federal deficit seems straightforward to fix. The government is spending more than it's collecting in revenue, and policymakers must close the gap. Beneath that view, however, is a far more complex reality. Contributor Larry Haas explains.
You know, I give a lot of speeches about the budget, and I often get the question, very much in the way that you posed it, well, what's the problem here? We're just spending too much. Let's just cut spending. And people seem to have the sense that the budget has a category which is called spending, just spending writ large. It's this kind of metaphysical thing. But the budget, of course, isn't just spending. It's real things for real people. They're there for a reason. We either want them or we need them. When you look at the budget, think about what dominates the budget. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, national security, homeland security, border safety, environmental protection, aid to education, housing, transportation, science, space, all of those things were put in the budget to serve a certain purpose. They all have support for major sectors of the American population, so that when you sort of say, well, why don't we just cut spending? The reason we can't just cut spending, the reason it's not that easy, is that people have an interest. They have a personal interest in what is currently part of the budget. And when you try to cut it, people howl. And to the extent that the program is ever more popular, they howl ever louder. And it makes it hard to cut spending.
Contributor Dave Walker.
There are two major types of direct spending, mandatory spending and discretionary spending. Mandatory spending represents spending on programs that, based upon current law, need to be met, and they're not subject to an annual limit. Discretionary spending represents federal spending on programs that are subject to annual limits and appropriations bills promulgated by the Congress and signed by the President. Interestingly, while at the beginning of the Republic, everything other than interest was deemed to be discretionary spending, today, you know, that's shrunk down to about 37% of the budget, and it's continuing to shrink. Ironically, discretionary spending includes all of the express and enumerated responsibilities envisioned by the founders for the federal government, all investments in our future, and all investments in children. And so what's happening is not only has the budget gotten bigger, but we've lost control of the budget. More and more the budget is on autopilot. More and more is for consumption and seniors. Less and less is controlled and is for investment and for young people. The largest government cost is direct spending, and yet tax expenditures are huge. For example, direct spending is about $3.8 trillion a year, of which about 63% of it is mandatory spending. And so, therefore, only about 37% of spending is really controlled, and that's going down. Tax expenditures represent about $1.1 trillion a year, and they're not controlled at all. These basically aren't in the budget. They're not in the financial statements. They're not subject to periodic review and reexamination, and they need to be treated just the same as direct spending, the same degree of scrutiny to make sure that they're either that they're working and that we're getting an appropriate return on investment.
We hear a lot about the deficit and debt burden, and obviously these are very big challenges. But Dave Walker points out that the real challenge is not where we are, not where we've been, but where we're headed. And this directly concerns our national competitiveness.
Well, from a fiscal standpoint, a lot of people are concerned about current deficits and debt levels, and understandably so. But the real challenge is not where we are, not where we've been, but where we're headed. We have huge unfunded obligations for Medicare, for Social Security. We face a range of other commitments and contingencies, you know, dealing with housing and other types of guarantees that are much, much greater than the amount of, you know, debt and liabilities that we have right now. So we need to start focusing on the future and recognizing that we're on an imprudent and unsustainable path and that we're going to have to make changes. The sooner we make those changes, the better, so that we can avoid a U.S. debt crisis, so that we can phase in the changes, and so that we can get the power of compounding working for us rather than against us as it is now.
Larry Haas elaborates.
What you need to keep in mind as you look forward is to focus on the singularly important issue of health care. First of all, we are an aging society. It costs more to treat an old person than a young person. Now, we have that in common with much of the world. Europe is aging, Asia is aging, so it's not like it's anyone's fault here. It's just the case that people are living longer, and that's a great thing. But while they're living longer, and it costs more to treat them by way of healthcare costs in America have been rising far in excess of the rate of inflation and growing, in fact, faster than the economy itself is growing. So put a focus on both of those things. Aging society, rising healthcare costs, costs more to treat an older person than a younger person anyway, and now the coming in particular of the retirement of the baby boom generation, this cohort that was born between 1946 and 1964 that's just now becoming eligible for Medicare in particular, but also Medicaid, because senior citizens get their long-term care through Medicaid. So aging society, rising health care costs, retirement of the baby boomers, soaring costs for Medicare and Medicaid, and the longer you look out into the future, the more you see that our budget problem is essentially an aging and health care problem.
Many serious and important decisions, a grand bargain like no other, must be made to right the ship of government. Dave Walker and Larry Haas describe how the federal government's long-term fiscal condition appears very dire, while Chuck Pro underscores that the way we run and manage the federal government contributes significantly to whether our nation is competitive. Larry Haas.
Well, with regard to cultural values, you know, this is a country that was founded on certain principles and certain values, and one of them was thrift. I mean, you have, it sounds like a cliche, but it's really true. You have the old line from Benjamin Franklin, a penny saved is a penny earned. That was something that people believed back then. Balanced budgets were a real article of faith. Government budgets, personal budgets. Borrowing, debt was considered a bad thing. To the extent that we are used to more debt, it does undermine this founding principle of the republic. Now, the reason it's dangerous is that there is a limit to how much we can borrow. At a certain point, credit markets are going to decide, our lenders overseas, our lenders at home are going to decide that they've lent us enough money. They start getting worried about their investment. Will they ever see it come back? Will the government continue to be able to make the interest payments on the debt that are owed each year? To the extent that there is an irresponsible federal policy, which is what we have right now, it does undermine competitiveness because responsible federal policy on the budget and everything else is a principle of global competitiveness. The more we have a healthy budget, all else being equal, the more competitive the country will be. So it has implications, cultural and economic, in a very real sense of the term.
Next up, Steve Redburn discusses a new strategic approach for reforming our country's budgeting process. And Gail Fossler explains how governance is the new competitiveness imperative. When Governing to Win, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. How can we enhance national competitiveness? What about getting big things done in government? And how can government better manage risks and use resources more wisely? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. Hear from Comptroller General Gene Dodaro, SSA Commissioner Michael Astrew, Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp, NGA Director Tish Long, and Aaron Connaughton on the Air Force's strategic vision. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com. Welcome back to Governing to Win, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. At the core of any well-functioning government is a budget process that policymakers can use to make big decisions about resources in a rational manner. Steve Redburn, contributor to the IBM Center book Governing to Win, describes the federal budget process, but also how it has collapsed.
Well, first of all, there are two features of our process that are structural and constitutional that really we can't do much about. One is that we have divided responsibility between two branches of government, the President and Congress, who have to share power and agree on policies before they're legislated, and the budget is all done by legislation at the federal level. And then we also have a system of federal division between states and the federal government. So we have 50 autonomous states making their own budget decisions, that are sovereign, have their own sources of revenue. And even in other federal systems, there's more centralization and coordination of fiscal choices at the national level than there is in this country. So those are two enduring structural features that we're not going to change anytime soon. But the best way to describe the current process is really with the metaphor. If you've seen these slow motion replays of major car wrecks in a NASCAR race where all the pieces are flying apart and people are bouncing off one another and so on. That's really what has happened to the relatively orderly process that we've had since 1974 in both the Congress and the executive, but especially in Congress, the process has fragmented, flown apart. In the best of times, it was weak at the center, stovepiped, fragmented among committees, and so on. But recently, it has just stopped working. And so we've lurched from crisis to crisis. Appropriations have not been made on time. A lot of uncertainty for everyone because of the breakdown of that process at a bad time.
Redburn elaborates on how cutting spending without a strategic approach or raising tax rates without tax reform could risk a period of slow growth and austerity that could cripple all of our efforts and threaten our position in the world.
I mean, the simplest thing to do when you have to cut back in the short run because you're running huge deficits is to sort of cut across the board. It's intellectually easier, and politically it's a shortcut. Even in the short run, it does a lot of damage. Things change from year to year. You know, war ends, we have new challenges, a pandemic next year or a major natural disaster or something else looms up, or a new opportunity to invest in new technology, for example. So priorities change quite a bit from year to year. And when the government can't complete, when the congressional process breaks down and government can't complete appropriations or can't complete them on time at the start of the fiscal year in October, then there's a lot of hidden damage that's done across agencies having to essentially live with the terms and conditions and amounts that they lived with the year before, even though there's been a lot of change. And if you, on top of that, then are ratcheting down everybody, you have additional disconnects and inefficiencies that arise. That's the short term. But in the long term, if you're not more strategic and targeted in the way you invest your resources, if you just let things drift along and move incrementally and adjust at the margins, over time, government's critical contribution to the success of the economy and its growth weakens. And that's what's been happening on both the spending side and the tax side. Tax policy is a result of a lot of individual narrow choices that favor one use of capital or income over another. No one has, since 1986, revisited the whole income tax system. So a number of small changes in the tax code have accumulated to mean that there are over $1 trillion of tax expenditures or gaps in the tax structure that function much like spending, but are not treated like spending in the appropriations process and are never looked at. And many of them probably are not optimal use of our resources. So they're simultaneously reductions in taxes and increases in subsidies for particular sectors of the economy, such as the mortgage interest deduction for home ownership, that are potentially counterproductive. In fact, in that case, did great damage to people's savings and net worth over the last 3 or 4 years.
So what does it mean to apply a strategic approach to the federal budget process? And does such an approach take into account the implications, long-term costs, or social benefits of current policy on the government's ability to meet future needs? Steve Redburn continues.
If we're going to stabilize the debt and we're going to align revenues and spending over a long horizon so that we have a sustainable fiscal path, if we're going to do that, having run the numbers many times on this, we can't do it arithmetically unless we have solid economic growth over a long period of time. So we have to have a faster rate of growth. And to do that, we have to have higher productivity throughout the economy. And we need to look at the federal government's contribution to that productivity. One of the keys that McKinsey and Company identified in a recent analysis to higher productivity in the whole economy is increasing the productivity of federal spending and tax expenditures, and also reforming the tax code so it's a much more efficient collector of revenue. So we really need to use the federal budget process strategically to raise public sector productivity if we're going to have the rate of growth necessary to stabilize the fiscal outlook long term. And that's why we need a strategic approach. We can't just cut incrementally or across the board.
Redburn outlines practical steps required to move toward a more strategic way of budgeting.
This act, which builds on the earlier GPRA that I mentioned, codifies a lot of the innovations that were put in place in the previous administration, such as creating performance improvement officers in each of the major agencies and a council, it's called the PIC, the Performance Improvement Council, of those officers. They have also put into law many of the requirements and streamline some of them for developing strategic plans and for agency performance plans and for setting targets at the agency level. But beyond that, and this is the most innovative, I think, an interesting opportunity offered by the new act that was passed at the end of 2010, is it requires the executive branch to define a limited set of federal priority goals that cut across jurisdictions, such as the one I mentioned that's a fairly low-level goal of dealing with environmental conditions in coastal wetlands, but also for reducing and eliminating homelessness among veterans, for example, is another goal that the Obama administration set at the beginning, which fits this model, where you have multiple agencies and programs all aimed at achieving that goal, and you plan together strategically to find the best strategy and to drive improvement. The homelessness goal is a good one to look at because there's actual documented success there. There's a successful strategy that was identified in the previous administration and is being applied, which essentially is a housing-first strategy that takes people off the street, out of emergency shelters, who are chronically homeless, and puts them in a private apartment, links them with services, and helps stabilize them, and in some cases get them back into the economic mainstream. Very strong base of evidence that shows that that's cost-effective, that it roughly costs the same amount for government to keep people on the street and using emergency services and so on, getting in trouble with the law, as it does to use this alternative, which is much better for them and allows you to see the possibility of reducing and ending that kind of homelessness, which is a blight on our cities and our society and very inhumane. So we see progress. We've seen a double-digit drop in the number of homeless veterans in the last annual count. So there's evidence that that strategy is working. It's an example of setting a goal that cuts across programs and agencies and then driving improvement by using resources more effectively to achieve that. And that's an opportunity that is now presented by the new act. And the administration has, in its latest budget proposals, identified a number of other similar goals around which it's going to organize reviews and then propose strategies and drive improvement. So that's the opportunity, and that fits very nicely with the model of the portfolio budgeting approach that I mentioned earlier.
Yet in the end, with all the difficult issues facing government executives, the real import is, how will making strategic choices increase the productivity of federal investments and enhance national competitiveness? Steve Redburn explains.
Well, we'll know we're budgeting more strategically when we see resources flowing to higher priority and more productive uses. When we see, again, this is in the eye of the beholder to some extent, but we see things like the mortgage interest deduction and other lower priority uses of resources being eliminated in favor of things that have a high return, a high payoff, like investments in early childhood education and health that show they have a lifetime of benefit and bring people into the economic mainstream and restore the kinds of opportunities that people used to have throughout the society. So we'll see that, and then we'll see as a result the federal government contributing to faster economic growth, and that is, as I said, critical to stabilizing the budget, but also to all the other things that we want to achieve as a society. So that's how we'll know when we're succeeding.
In a world of intense mobility of value and resources, one element remains unique to the national character, a nation's governing structures. These structures include the formal institutions of government, the process by which legal, economic, and social decisions are made. It is through these institutions, processes, and practices that a nation can take control of the sources of economic success and find resolutions to barriers that stand in the way of a balanced prosperity. Gail Fossler, contributor to Governing to Win, defines governance and explains how it constitutes a competitive advantage.
Governance is basically the explicit and implicit rules that guide your behavior. I think it's important to recognize that the most pervasive form of governance is self-governance. Mm-hmm. So governance is the process by which we establish goals, by which we vet options, by which we choose and innovate, experiment with respect to options, public options. You know, we've usually regarded government and governance and what I might call governing frameworks, that is how we go about identifying our goals, how we discuss our goals, how we discuss what are the most efficient means of meeting our goals as a country, what are the practices that we apply in the public sector in terms of delivering public goods and social goods. We've usually regarded that as sort of part of our domestic agenda. And what I'm saying here is that this is at our core, this is our national competitiveness agenda, because it is the one thing that among all those, you know, people, innovation, capital, financial flows, it is the one thing that is unique to our fortress.
Fossler describes four elements that are key to national competitiveness.
First is an educated workforce. Second is having the resources, and that is not just the physical resources, but the decision-making resources to be able to meet your goals in the international international marketplace. The third is a favorable regulatory environment. And actually, I thought it was interesting that number four was what you might call traditional cost competitiveness.
She also identifies specific actions that can be taken to restore national competitiveness.
Well, most of those actions align with the problems, which is we actually ask those questions in two different sections, and then we see if indeed there is an alignment. But education is really a very top priority of the business community. And in a more recent survey where we were asking about the presidential agenda, you know, looking forward into the election year, you know, usually education and energy policy wasn't particular to this competitiveness, particular set of competitiveness questions. But I was surprised that education and energy, which is usually very specific and it ranks fairly far down the list, these two policy issues ranked just under pro-growth economic policies and general budget and tax alignment. So these issues, I mean, the business community the business community is very consistent in wanting pro-growth economic policies, wanting an educated workforce, wanting a resolution of the deficit issues. Actually, they're very singularly aligned behind tax reform. Mm-hmm. And then finally, regulatory reform. So the things the business community wants stacks up very cleanly against those things they think would make America competitive.
Gail Fossler explains how this sets up a new national competitive paradigm.
Well, it makes you step back. And actually, I was just at lunch talking to Mike Mandel, the former chief economist of Business Week. And we were talking about healthcare, and he started out with, what are we trying to achieve? And actually, in my budget experience, with respect to the economy, we spent 3 months arguing in a partisan way, but in a genial way, about what were the objectives, what was the role of the budget in achieving national economic growth, what were our full employment objectives, what were our objectives with respect to, you know, what were reasonably non-inflationary objectives given the time frame that we were in. And so, you know, if we think about the budget discussions that we have today, they all seem, to my mind, to sort of begin at the end, which is that they're all, we're talking about taxes and spending, 3 for 1, 2 for 1, and the like, and there's almost no debate about what are we trying to achieve here? What are the key components of a pro-growth agenda? How do we prioritize those in terms of our public resources? How do we go about culling out of our public agenda those things that maybe could be done in a more efficient way or where people should be taking bigger responsibility? And so we need to, you know, very much, I use the analogy of a business, but we need to establish a strategy. We need to establish some goals, some accountability, some strategies, and then back those into how we think about the decisions we make with respect to public resources and public services.
Fossler points out that national competitiveness is closely linked with the perception of a nation's global economic leadership potential.
I think that's a great question. And if I may, maybe I'm betraying the parts of the newspaper that I read relative to other parts of the newspaper. But there was an article in the last couple of weeks on what you think of yourself is a function of what you wear. Okay, now imagine that. Probably your wife tells you that all the time. But the truth is that how you see yourself is in part a function of your ability as a person to break through your own, whatever your own problems are, your job, you know, your personal habits, your struggles in your marriage, your problems with your family. And as you make progress in being able to express your own power in the world, you develop confidence that things that you never even imagined you will be able to tackle. And so there is a deep psychological link, I think, between our ability to tackle these problems and gain confidence and how we see ourselves in terms of a global leader. And in some ways, I think we're suffering from a lack of national confidence.
For Gail Fossler, the U.S. is not so much over-consuming as it's consuming inefficiently, both in the public and private spheres.
Well, I think that's another kind of iconoclastic point of view, and I appreciate the challenging way in which you ask that question. But you know, if you look at just basic consumer spending, you know, consumer spending growth was running in the 2 to 3% range for most of the last decade. Mm-hmm. These are not high rates by U.S. average, and everybody always looks at consumption as a percent of GDP. But one of the reasons that it is as high as it is a lot of that consumption was consumption of products that were made abroad. Okay, hence our GDP was relatively smaller or was reduced by that, you know, maybe overconsumption from abroad. But the point that I was making is that a lot of what is pressing both in terms of government budgets, but also pressing in terms of personal budgets is what we used to think of as social welfare costs, but it is the rising cost of education and it's the rising cost of health care. It's actually the rising cost of public services generally. If we look at what we are consuming, and a lot of that is embodied in the budget, okay, because these are other than national defense and, you know, some foreign aid and, you know, maybe a few regulatory bodies, most of what we see in terms of federal and state budgets are benefits that come back to people. It may come back to people who are the different people than the ones who are paying the bills, but it is a fundamental consumption market. And when you look at that consumption relative to what it's costing us, you have to argue that it's inefficient.
In fact, inefficiency plagues many aspects of government delivery, which hinders national competitiveness. For example, the federal government purchases more than $500 billion worth of goods and services each year, buying everything from pens and paper to engineering services and fighter jets. As another contributor to the IBM Center book, Governing to Win, Raj Sharma points out many experts agree that the government purchasing process is cumbersome and inefficient.
Well, it's just an extremely, extremely complex environment. I've thought about three or four key reasons. One is, you look at every department out there, they're extremely decentralized. First of all, these are very large, complex bureaucracies to begin with, and then they're very decentralized. So the people at the top, yes, they control policy, et cetera, but in many ways, the funding, whether it's through appropriations, et cetera, flows down directly to sub-organizations. And so it's very decentralized. Having any kind of coordination and control is very difficult. The process, then, of that's dictated through the FAR as well as just through other policies that are layered on top is extremely complex. So as we know, the intent of the FAR is really to ensure best value. But in many ways, it works against that because of the complexity. We've layered so much complexity that it's created extra costs both for
operating the procurement process as well as for the supply chain partners. So they're incurring a lot of costs. Third is really this is one of the defining areas that I think adds the most complexity is stakeholders in terms of whether we're looking at responding to congressional requests or we're talking about special interest groups. Just knowing what those set of stakeholders are, what policies or what areas they might be interested in. For instance, we need to comply with small business goals, right? And there's a whole small business lobby and interest groups around that. Again, nobody would disagree with those goals, but it just adds complexity in terms of when where private sector entities may be able to just think about, okay, how do we streamline our supply chain and go to one supplier in that example? Mm-hmm. Federal government can't do that. And the fourth is funding. Really, the way the funding flows through appropriations, a lot of times a single-year process, as well as we know that anybody who's lived in this town knows about continuing resolutions. Mm-hmm. So all of those things really add a level of inefficiency mm-hmm. because suppliers, when one, programs aren't able to plan, two, suppliers don't have visibility into how much business are they really going to get? So that adds more cost for them as a result.
Sharma acknowledges that the current fiscal environment provides an unprecedented opportunity to not only transform the way government purchases, but the way it manages its supply chain.
There are a couple of things going on right now. One, everybody knows the whole budget picture, no matter where you live. You don't have to be in D.C. to understand that. So this is really the best time. There's never been a time that I can remember where agencies really have to start to think about how do we live within its means and actually do more with less. And then the acquisition process itself, because of some of the pitfalls and some of the issues that have happened over time, has gotten so much scrutiny. It's also because of the amount of money being spent, over $500 billion, that there's a lot of attention being paid to supply chain and procurement and all those issues, how government buys and manages. So that's really brought the attention at the leadership level. So it started to create more of a platform for what do we do about it. So we finally have the leadership's attention, as well as if we can tie it to the budget picture and say not only can the government reduce costs, but honestly, in the examples and the areas that I'll highlight, we can actually think by reducing costs because you're simplifying the process in many ways and taking the complexity away, you can actually be more effective while reducing cost.
Sharma suggests re-envisioning the role of government purchasing from managing purchases and price to managing supply chain and total cost.
All of the work that we do in the federal government in terms of purchasing, or most of it, it's really on individually managing contracts, transactions. As much as we talk about best value, it is about managing the price of that transaction. What are we negotiating for that? Price is just a small component of the total cost, so we really need to look at the whole picture. And then two, we need to take a step back and say, What are the types of things we're buying? Who are we buying them from? Mm-hmm. What are our biggest supply chains, mm-hmm. right? And then how do we manage them? How do we, instead of really reacting to every transaction, every need, say, what's the long-term outlook? What does the need look like? What are the set of capabilities resident in the suppliers, mm-hmm. right? And how do we best work together over the long term? So it's really moving to a much more strategic way of looking at what are our long-term needs, how does it help us accomplish certain goals, and then who are the partners that we want to work with over time, mm-hmm. and then really set up a process and a roadmap to execute against that as opposed to every transaction comes in and then reacting to it.
What are the end goals to rethinking government purchasing and its supply chain? Here's Raj Sharma.
Technology, as I say, it's an enabler, right? It's the end goal isn't to implement technology. It's really, if we look at, you know, what are the end goals of, you know, what we want out of the system of contracting and procurement, it's really around, can we have a more transparent process? Can we better manage cost, right? Can we better understand capabilities of suppliers out there? So a holistic strategy really should be grounded in enabling those set of things. Can we get visibility into performance? Can we also start to create more of a dynamic competitive marketplace? Can we also start to gain more market intelligence into the supplier capabilities? Mm-hmm. So those are the types of things. And they're not all things that you can address through technology. Frankly, you need the human element and the talent on top of that as well. But there are many things going on out there that are already available that government can leverage.
Next up, how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance national competitiveness? We'll explore this question and what the future holds when Governing to Win, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, returns. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com. How can we enhance national competitiveness? What about getting big things done in government? And how can government better manage risks and use resources more wisely? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. Hear from Comptroller General Gene Dodaro, SSA Commissioner Michael Astrew, Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp, NGA Director Tish Long, and Aaron Connaughton on the Air Force's strategic vision. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to Governing to Win, a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. It's not all bad news. There are some positive signs, pockets of best practices that can be applied more consistently across the whole of government. Governing to Win ends by outlining a value-oriented enterprise operating model for the federal government based on commercial experience, which could lower operating costs while improving mission performance and services to citizens. Once again, here's the book's editor, Chuck Pro.
You know, companies are measured on EBITDA, how much cash do they generate, and ROI, how effectively do they turn that cash. It's very clear. When you move to the government, I mean, the government, as much as we like to oversimplify it, is not like running a company. It's very different. And the men and women who serve the government in these capacities do a very, very good job in a very, very difficult environment. And what this book attempts to do is to provide clarity around what value is in the federal government. The federal government comprises dozens and dozens of missions, and those missions are typically statutorily defined. They're very clear. And those missions can be measured. And what the book tries to outline is a very, very simple proposition that says that all of these missions are required to have a certain level of service, perform a certain level of quality for a certain amount of cost and a certain amount of time. And anything we can do to take time or cost out of one of these missions without negatively affecting service or quality, by definition, is a good thing. The big dimension of the equation is time. Because, I mean, ultimately at its core, the federal government is composed of dozens and dozens of white-collar processes. These white-collar processes typically have bottlenecks. Anything we can do as government and as industry serving government to take time out of the service and out of the mission without negatively impacting mission effectiveness will ultimately drive increased value. That should not be the primary focus. The primary focus is improving national competitiveness. And we're going to improve national competitiveness by more effectively performing government missions at a much lower cost point.
For Chuck Pro, this new operating model could catalyze similar changes in the broader economy, thereby improving productivity and enhancing national competitiveness. As we turn to the future, to what extent is our conversation, the book itself, and this whole discussion around U.S. competitiveness more a call to action rather than one of despair? Once again, former Comptroller General Dave Walker.
Look, there's no question that the United States is a great nation, arguably the greatest in the history of mankind. But we've got some serious challenges. We have strayed from the principles and values that made us great. We do face a range of key sustainability challenges that threaten our future position in the world and our future standard of living at home. But it's not too late. If we learn from history, if we learn from others, if our leaders start leading, if the people, we the people, start putting pressure on our elected officials to act, to address large and known and growing problems before they reach a crisis, if we make the political price of doing nothing greater than the political price of making tough choices that involve some, you know, shared sacrifice today in order to help create a much better tomorrow, then we'll all be better off. I believe that can happen, and I take hope in the fact that we've always risen to meet a challenge historically. I think we'll do so again this time, but we need to do it before we have a U.S. debt crisis, which would have devastating consequences not just here at home but around the world. And for that to happen, as I said, two things need to occur. One, the president, whoever it is, has to demonstrate extraordinary leadership. Talk about the challenges, the opportunities, a way forward. Use the bully pulpit to go directly to the American people. And then the American people have to put pressure on their elected officials to act in our common interest in order to help ensure that our future will be better than our past. I think that can happen. I hope that it will happen. And 2013 is key.
Contributor Gail Fossler.
First, and these are my predilections, you know, and I come at this as an economist, an analyst, and somebody who has rubbed up against the governance process in a number of ways in my career. But I hope that we get a clean political sheet after the election, that we begin to have a discussion around what these national domestic goals might be, that we may need some new institutions, some kind of collective institution that is able to do long-term, unbiased research. The Congressional Budget Office actually does an amazing job in that regard for the Congress. The ability to create a fact base. We need something that represents a continuum from administration to administration about what our challenges are, and in part, because that is a competitive innovation, my hope would be also that we would have a political process that would exhibit some interest in how things really work. Okay, like we mentioned, healthcare, Medicare. Every person over the age of 65 has some form of supplemental insurance, either Medicaid or private insurance, in part because they don't know what Medicare covers, and they don't know what it's going to cover. And that creates a real disconnect between the body politic and the political leadership, because people feel as if they cannot trust the institution of governance, the governance institutions, to act in their best interest. And that's probably the greatest risk that we face today.
Larry Haas. I tend to be an optimist. It's very easy to look around, see the paralysis in Washington, see the political gridlock, and assume that somehow we're never going to find a way out of our mess, that politics have moved in a certain direction, and what they mean is that we'll never come together on a responsible fiscal policy. But I would suggest that we keep a few things in mind. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, we did go through an era of very large budget deficits in the 80s and early 1990s, and through some very courageous action, through presidents of both parties, congresses of both parties, through various stages in the 80s and 90s, we took action that, combined with a strong economy, moved us from deficits to surpluses. It was not that long ago. In historical terms, it was literally the blink of an eye. If we did it in the 80s and 90s, we can do it today. Secondly, This country, over time, has always found a capacity to act when it really needed to. But you see, it comes down to Churchill's line about America.